This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anatoly Karlin. We're going to be discussing the topics of future trends, automation. Anatoly, great having you on.
Thank you. It's great being on here as usual.
And I'm also joined here with Rabbit and my co-host, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you, like always, guys.
Hey, guys.
When the last time we talked, it was about the French election. And Anatoly, you did write an article about the French election results.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was disappointed, but I wasn't surprised. I was expecting Le Pen to do slightly better, but that's pretty much what we were predicting. The few interesting observations about your article was her performance among the youth vote, and she did do impressively well there. And that's something where there's this perception that the millennial generation is all in favor of the liberal establishment, and that's a major misconception. The other interesting observation you had was about the overseas vote, where basically the overseas French population overwhelmingly supported Macron, with the exception of Syria. But keep in mind, it didn't mention the breakdown, so some countries could have been closer than others. It's just a winner or loser, basically.
Well, yeah, obviously, and in some countries that only have been 10 people voting, like in the Central African Republic, perhaps. So I do have an article about this. I have several articles about it. So the good thing, I suppose, is that Le Pen did get twice more than the previous best. So Jean-Marie Le Pen got 18% in 2002. This time she got 35%. So I suppose in this sense, it's a victory. On the other hand, I wouldn't be rushing off to celebrate anytime soon because, first of all, she was facing off against the embodiment of an empty suit Bugman, who is Macron, like Rothschild banker, and he was a minister in the previous government of Hollande, which has an approval rating in the single digits. And she moderated her own position, so she really made a lot of efforts to clean up, polish up the position of the FN. So remove any discussions of the Jewish question, for instance, like her father was a fan of. So that all else equal, that should have actually just increased the FN's share of the vote. And actually, yes, on first glance, it is encouraging that the share of the vote amongst the youth increases relative to that of the French boomers, who just overwhelmingly vote for the establishment.
The middle-aged people who came of age, they're called the 68 generation. They're the most left-wing age demographic in France.
Well, no, they're not left-wing. They're conservatives. So they are boomer conservatives, basically, because they voted overwhelmingly for Fillon, and they're much more religious than younger French people.
Religious voters favored Fillon. Le Pen supporters were fairly secular, and I actually see the same trend in American conservatism, where the alt-right actually is fairly secular compared to mainstream Republicans.
Well, yes, and that is also the case in France. But I wouldn't overdo this whole thing about the youth like running off to Le Pen, well, apart from those of them who are Muslims, of course, because obviously we know that there's far more Muslims than amongst the younger generations and amongst the older ones. But I'd also want to emphasize another thing. First of all, turnip is low amongst young people than older people. Those young people who didn't turn up were primarily Mélenchon voters, so far leftist and far left voters. That's first. And secondly, actually support for Le Pen peaks amongst the people who are middle-aged, not the young people, but people who are in their 30s and 40s. not people who are in their late teens and 20s. And that's deliberately disturbing because, I mean, if those attitudes are indeed set, then we're not going to be seeing any sort of national resurgence amongst that Generation Z. It's just going to be, Le Pen, in that case, the nationalists aren't going to be in power in 2022, and then the impacts of the Islamic immigration will really be getting felt, and power will be increasingly impossible.
Do you see Macron as accelerating Islamic immigration the way that becoming another Merkel, or basically keeping kind of the status quo?
Well, I mean, he's certainly very friendly with Merkel, and he has publicly declared that France could be taking more immigrants. Obviously, when immigration isn't very popular amongst the French nowadays, I perhaps there could be some concession to political electoral realities, the initial signs aren't impressive at all, obviously, and encouraging.
What are some of your observations on the trends of the overseas French voters in different countries? Do you have statistics, or just which are just winner versus loser, or do you have more intricate statistics?
Obviously, I mean, overseas French voters overwhelmingly voted for Macron. This is a common pattern overseas. American voters overwhelmingly voted for Obama and for Hillary Clinton. In Russia, even in amongst Russians, overseas voters, a lot more of them vote for liberal candidates than relative to what they get in Russia itself. And the reason for that is pretty simple. Foreign nationals who end up being abroad are students and businessmen. They are these bohemian hipster types, these bebos, as Charles Murray and that French sociologist person called them, or they're like the Belmont emigres, as Charles Murray would say. They're like really upper class people who are fine with diversity. It doesn't impact them very negatively. They don't have any connections with the proletarian areas of their countries. This is just a global trend that we can see in France, but which we also see in the United States, and which we even see in Russia. I mean, funnily enough.
Syria was the one outlier, and that probably has to do with
one exception. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. I mean, it's a funny exception, and it's not an overly surprising one, perhaps. I assume it's because Le Pen, in her public statements, is a lot less interventionist than Macron, and I imagine that a lot of French citizens who would have been voting from Syria might be like Christian Levantines or who do support Assad much more than they do the jihadis. And so they would naturally prefer Le Pen over Macron. So I think there's a clear electoral reason if that logic is correct. But obviously this is just a tiny demographic group that doesn't really have any wider significance.
Rabbit, do you want to comment on the French election?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. I think what we're seeing is kind of just a race against time, really, because more French people are waking up, and Le Pen did better in this election than in the 2002 ones, and also other previous ones. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that trend is going to continue. It might actually be maxed out, because as the demographics continue to change, there's going to be less French people available to vote for these nationalist candidates, even if they continue to gain, even if pretty soon, if every, white French person votes for Le Pen or something, it may not be enough because the demographics will continually change.
Yes.
So I think that's a long-term problem. So I think people that see that, you know, say like, oh, well, she got 35%, you know, think how well she's going to do next time. Well, but, you know, if you know, they get swamped with more and more of these refugees and migrants, the demographics are going to change further. And France actually has a law where if you're French, you're just French. Like they don't actually even collect data on these, you know, ethnicities that are in France. So a lot of the people that are, you know, polled as being French or whatever are, you know, actually like Algerians and people who migrated from the 60s and 70s that have had children and just kind of been absorbed into the society. They have a law that says you can't collect racial data on people. And, you know, when we talk about the support being, you know, strongest among people in their 30s and 40s, well, you know, one of the reasons it's going to be, the support is going to be less among younger people than that is because a lot of them are, you know, they're not really French, you know, so it's kind of like in Brexit, you know, in Great Britain, they made a big deal about the fact that like it was supported by older people, but, you know, not the young people were, you know, overwhelmingly supporting staying in the EU. And it's like, well, duh, a lot of those young people they're not even British, really. You know, they're people who might have British citizenship, you know, but they might be, you know, from the Middle East or from India or from Poland or these places. So naturally, they're not going to feel any solidarity or any need to support any kind of British identity because, what would they care? So I think that's just something that is often left out of these polls. It's just the actual breakdown of it.
As far as American politics go, Anatoly, have you followed any research on trends towards the voters who are the new generation, Generation Z, which is, I guess that's people born since the year 2000, or it can include voters, I guess as far as voters go, maybe the really youngest voters, like 18 to 20, have there been any trends on their political views, or it's too soon to tell? Or you just see them as carbon copies of the millennials?
I mean, there's been polls that show that Generation Z is more conservative than the millennials, but they were still in school when those polls were carried out, and when you're in school, you sort of are more conformist, and it's only when you go to university, it's like only when you reach your teens that you start rebelling. When you go to the university, as you start encountering all these postmodernists and Marxists and other ways of thinking, I suppose. So I think I'm skeptical that there's going to be some major tilt back towards the diet amongst Generation Z, personally.
So on to our topic for the show is we're going to be talking about the effects of automation in the future. And I really do see this as being the main political issue in the 21st century. Do you see this as surpassing issues like immigration and trade as the most crucial issue?
Well, I mean, I suppose it all depends on how far automation will go. I mean, if automation, if you include the development of super intelligences into automation, then obviously that will like make pretty much everything else irrelevant. I mean, if we're just speaking of automation as a process that gradually replaces easily automated routine jobs such as call centers and manufacturing and truck drivers, I mean, to some extent it will actually accentuate already existing differences caused by human biodiversity, in my opinion, and I can explain why.
You've touched on this briefly on a previous show, but you said that automation will affect a lot of these issues that the alt-right is concerned about, primarily low-skilled immigration and dysgenics. Can you explain your take on that?
Oh, well, the primary point I would like to make is that we're not probably aware of the close correlation between economic performance and average IQ levels. So this is true between countries. So, I mean, the United States is richer than Mexico with an average IQ of 85, which is richer than the Republic of the Congo with an IQ of 70. And it's also true within countries as well. So, I mean, Massachusetts with an IQ of average IQ of 104 or something is richer than and better and more civically minded than West Virginia with an average IQ of 96. So what's the major difference that automation will make is that it will, at least initially, the general consensus is that it will primarily affect simpler jobs. So jobs which are more easily automated, which are more routine, and which are less G-loaded. So which where duller people tend to work. And so
basically, the major ones are the fast food industry, trucking with self-driving trucks, and also agriculture.
Agriculture, yes, call centers and things like this. So the people, probably the last people to be fully automated are the people who design the robots. I mean, once you replace the people who design the robots, then hopefully the machine who replaces that is friendly towards us, because otherwise would be in a bit of trouble. But that's probably half a century off or so, if not longer. What will functionally happen in the next few decades as these lower end jobs get automated is that the impact of the so-called smart factions is going to become even bigger than it was. Because all these duller people, a lot of them will simply become, in economic terms, dead weight. And this will create economic issues. So you'll have presumably increasing unemployment or perhaps they will be employed, but I mean, the wages will collapse, and you'll probably need to start thinking about instituting some sort of universal basic income a few decades down the line as this process continues. And national wealth will increasingly depend on just two factors. First, the size of your pool of highly smart, high IQ people, which due to the bell curve will primarily be those regions which have higher average national IQs in the first place. And secondly, it will be those regions and countries with less minimalistic regulations, economic regulations, assuming that economic globalization continues. Because all else equal, corporations would prefer to base their manufacturing in regions where they don't have to pay as much tax and so on.
What effect will this have with the automation on immigration trends and birth rate trends?
Well, I mean, it depends. So there's two questions we have to ask in terms of the effects on fertility. First off, will people have enough money to reproduce and have surviving children? I mean, I assume that assuming that some sort of democracy survives, then the electoral pressure to institute a basic income will gradually become overwhelming. And if there is wide-scale automation, I think, and people don't become immiserated, then I'm assuming that fertility might well actually go up. Because obviously, if you're just getting income and you don't have to go to work, then presumably family formation would be easier, all other things equal.
I saw this study by CityLab, and CityLab is a publication, online publication through The Atlantic, which pretty much they have a pretty strong neoliberal agenda, but they do have a lot of interesting articles about cities and urban planning issues. But they put out this report where automation poses the biggest threat to American jobs. And these are just projections, but their projections that the cities that will be harmed the most by automation are primarily largely working class Hispanic cities, places like the Inland Empire in California, Las Vegas, which is mostly a service sector city,
yes,
will be hit pretty hard. Then basically you have these middle class white cities like Salt Lake City and places like Minnesota, Wisconsin, and then basically they project a either they'll be slightly harmed or a more neutral effect. And then basically this goes back to what you were saying, is places where there's more of a cognitive elite and a not like information based economy, places like the Silicon Valley, the Northern Virginia, the Research Triangle, and North Carolina. Those are the places that will probably prosper the most in the future, as their predictions.
And Seattle. So yeah, I mean, that tallies with this cognitive interpretation that I'm offering. And that seems to be what will happen. I assume that countries which have taken in a lot of low IQ immigrants to bolster their labor forces in the past couple of decades, they'll be feeling pretty stupid once this goes around.
No, I agree. I think that one thing that we've seen though is that people are starting to know that that there's not going to be jobs for these people, and that there's less of a requirement for this low-skilled labor, but just for humanitarian reasons, they just like insist that we just have to bring in unlimited amounts of these people, like no matter what. Like, so it's almost like they concede many of these arguments in terms of like automation and in terms of these people bringing wages down and so forth and making it harder for locals to get jobs here, but it seems like they just don't care. They just want to bring in unlimited amounts anyways, and I find that to be kind of disturbing, in a way that we have to bring them in no matter what. Like, even this is laid out, they understand it.
There's the humanitarian argument that that was the main argument put forth for the whole migrant crisis in Europe. But then there's the economic argument that we need the cheap labor. But I was reading an article fairly recently that Napa Valley is beginning to automate their the wine industry there for picking grapes.
I completely agree. I mean, humanitarianism does play some role, especially with regards to the entry of 2 million refugees into Europe, but primarily these arguments are economic in nature, and I don't even think that it's a fault of economics per se, but of economists who insist on treating labor as an undifferentiated pool that's completely interchangeable and equivalent across sources of origin. Not many economists just seem want to adjust for the different levels of human capital sources of labor of labor forces produce, and some economists do adjust for it. So, like most prominently, Garrett Jones, who wrote The Hive Mind a couple of years ago, but 90% of them do not. They just treat a worker from Nigeria and a worker from Switzerland as being interchangeable, pretty much, or at least their children as interchangeable. And that's a really big problem.
I also think automation will create a new political realignment. Right now, the immigration issue is pretty much you have upper class whites and Hispanics on one side versus working class whites divided over immigration, but the automation issue could create a political realignment where it will be less racially divided and more economically divided between the working class and the rich. I mean, that's a likely scenario. Anatoly, do you see that scenario fulfilling out, or do you see politics going more in a racially polarized direction?
Well, I mean, I assume that there's going to be increasing demands for a universal basic income once automation really starts getting into gear. And I suppose there might be some sort of alliance of convenience between Hispanics and Fishtown or lower class whites on this issue. Although whether they will opt to do it through the same political parties is another question, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to predict these political realignments. We could have like a more socialist party, a working class, white-oriented party, and a plutocratic party. But it's really difficult to kind of predict these political realignments because we've seen them throughout history and they're unpredictable. As mm-hmm. far as the basic income goes, I agree with you completely. It is going to be a necessity. But the key questions are how to implement it, where to get the funding. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different proposals because through automation will create a massive profits for the businesses that are utilizing it. But then you have to say if that revenue is going to be put to profits, how it's important to put it towards a basic income. One scenario is that you could see the top 1% continuing to get wealthier because of automation, but they may give out a basic income, but it could be a measly amount. So just to keep people from totally revolting. So it could be maybe something like $15,000 a year, which is basically a poverty level, but it's not enough to sustain for people who want to start a family or will basically not be a middle class. So that's one scenario of a basic income.
Miss Tizo Gamer Underclass clicking sponsored content all day.
Yeah,
on a soy diet that was this Thug Twitter, the classic Thug Twitter tweet about this.
So the key questions with the basic income are how to implement it and how to generate the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And the other issue is where to put the limitations, because I think it's absolutely necessary. If you give a basic income, should the basic income be given to children or given to foreign nationals? I think it is crucial to limit it to adults who are U.S. citizens, to prevent a massive growth in the underclass and to create an incentive for mass immigration. But other than that, I do think it is a crucial issue. The just key questions are how to successfully implement it.
Oh, of course. And we'll be talking a lot about it. The one proposal that's been gaining down recently is just taxing robots because they sort of are now starting to directly replace the labor force, and unlike capital, you have to pay the wages. So this is like a tax on the robots. I don't think that's a good idea at all, because it's just a disincentive to automation, and I do think that automation is a good thing.
You're not 100% against automation. You think if it's done the right way, there could actually be positive benefits.
Well, look, the thing is, it's not really even something about me being for or against it. I'm just saying that it's going to be something that will happen whether you like it or not, simply because it will be extremely competitive, and the countries that embrace automation will be more competitive than those who try to restrict it. So I don't think that's really worthy of being debated very much. So, I mean, the main what I would propose is that the coming of automation will massively enrich the oligarchs, the people who own the capital, because I mean, this will just be labor directly working for them, which they own, but which doesn't complain, doesn't and hands over all of their earnings directly to the oligarch, and this expansion of inequality that we've seen in the past 20, 30 years, it's going to be absolutely dwarfed by this next expansion of inequality that is just around the corner. And Really, we should be thinking that once that happens, we should be thinking about just increasing taxes on the Dutch. I think increasing the marginal rate of income tax.
That makes the most sense.
I mean, obviously, you'll still have the classic problems of people of the oligarchs trying to find ways of evading taxes. So to offshore methods or to legal methods, I'm not a specialist on this. And I mean, obviously, you always have to think about the optimal balance between going too far or not going far enough. But probably the balance will shift more towards higher tax rate. But I mean, I haven't really thought about this specific scenario a lot. I mean, what do you think, Rabbit?
I mean, I agree. I think that it's coming, you know, whether we like it or not. I actually like automation. I would like, you know, to see, you know, a world with much less people, you know, and just more open and with more of these, you know, machines and things involved. I think that, you know, as far as like the basic income and that, I think that as far as the U.S. has to be broken up before anything really cohesive can be done, because there are too many different regional conflicts and differences in order to have any kind of real cohesive policy about anything, I think. And there's way too many people in the U.S. I think to implement a successful, you know, a successful universal like a wage policy or anything like that, because the regions are too different and too many of the different kinds of people hate each other. I think something like that has to, you almost need a future with smaller states in order to be able to manage this sort of thing, at least in the short term, you know, which could be why, you know, some of the smaller regional areas are so successful, but I think any kind of like a giant super state like the U.S. is going to have a hard time implementing this. I mean, we already have a national debt of like $18 trillion, so a lot of things are going to have to collapse and be reordered during this. I also think that in terms of automation, that a lot of the, you know, companies themselves tend to be resisting this kind of stuff. It almost reminds me of, I remember reading about in the Roman Empire, they wanted to rely too much on slave labor, and that in the later days that actually prevented them from continuing to find like technological advancements. And you see like a lot of, I think a lot of companies, and you see this with farms, is that they're resisting, you know, trying to find these kind of technological solutions, because they're just like, it's like with, you know, slavery in the South or whatever, they just want to like keep this thing going, you know, cause it's easy or whatever. And they almost have to, it's almost like, by restricting immigration and, you know, implementing, you know, higher minimum wage laws and things like that, it actually forces them to become more innovative when they've kind of become lax. I think Ron Unz made that argument in terms of the minimum wage, that actually, like, if you raise the minimum wage, then, you know, you might see some of these companies stop supporting mass immigration if they've got to pay these people $15 an hour, you know, to come here. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think that's interesting.
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, I'm not actually convinced that the United States is all that heterogeneous as you say. Another problem that I think might happen if you go to down the near reactionary proposal of breaking up the United States into different like city states and regions is that in practice, my vision of automation and its effect on the economy and politics is that there's going to be a further stratification, and a lot of the manufacturing that's spread out now will concentrate even further in the high average IQ places and in the places with favorable regulations. So that would indeed be the research triangle in the United States, maybe Seattle. And the rest of the country, I'm afraid, might actually like go down quite a bit after this.
The other issue with the basic income is creating a leisure class. I think for people like us who are writers, artists, bloggers, I think it would be a great thing to kind of free up this leisure class. But for your average normie person, it could lead to people who just spend all their time watching TV, becoming alcoholics, jerking off to porn. It could have a negative effect on the average person. I still think it's necessary to have a basic income, but that could be a likely scenario for just the average person. But for intellectuals and creative types, I think it would be great to have a basic income for them to kind of free them up.
Well, it's just like when you look at welfare or anything else, like some people, like there's a large percentage of people that really just can't handle it. You know, they really can't even, you know, they're not psychologically or mentally equipped to even handle that sort of thing. You know, you see that time and time again. You see people who are on welfare, but they use the money to buy like, you know, crack and Cheetos and like alcohol or whatever. You know, they find ways to game the system. You know, to use it in ways that it's not designed. They have more children so that they can get more money and so forth, or they have more children, even knowing that they're going to be even more broke. And then, you know, then the government has to pay for the health care of the children that they have. And it's just kind of like you have, I think, millions and millions of people that just are just not capable of living. And the key in my mind is, well, how do we separate ourselves from those kinds of people in order to form the kind of society we want to live in that works and is nice?
Well, I mean, welfare queens today, I mean, they are self-selected in the sense that they are like the very bottom ranks of society, the lumpen proletariat, as Marx called them. So, I think the existence of society is pretty inevitable. I don't think it's at all obvious that the average displaced worker would behave like the typical welfare dependent today. I mean, like even today in places like Germany, for instance, or France, first working hours are a lot less than in the United States. Americans work something like 1,900 hours per year, I think. For Germans and the French, it's something like 1,400. They've got a lot more holidays, but it doesn't seem to me that that Germans or French people like waste more of their time outside work than do Americans, say.
And also, it's not just economic, but they, in Germany and other parts of Europe, they have more of a culture where people are more into doing things that are outdoors, going hiking, and cultural pursuits. The way American society is set up, there's a lot of different factors. There's cultural factors. We have this suburban sprawl model. So people in America are more likely to spend time indoors watching TV, and they don't have the same outdoor culture that exists in Germany and other parts of Europe.
So the idea that Europeans spend a lot more time in the outdoors, whereas Americans tend to watch more TV in their free time, I don't know if that's true, actually. I mean, the Southerners, especially in the United States, have a great outdoors culture. So it doesn't seem to be obviously due to me.
Personally, where I live out in the forest, and there's my parents' house is outside.
Is it you talking about the Poconos?
Well, we've been to Poconos before. Pennsylvania is a very foresty area, but you know, my brother was saying this the other day that Philadelphia has the most city with the most trees, and there's a lot of greenery. Now, ironically, though, there's a lot of greenery in the white parts of the area near University of Penn. It looks like a little forest village, but when you get out, it gets all ghetto and yeah, and it gets all like kind of like a shady David Lynch town, just like, I don't know, like bad. And then it's you know, I don't know. That's an interesting thing. If environment has a lot to do with people's interest and that they make it in their own character. I mean, personally, I do like the greenery and I like going out to, you know, Valley Forge Park. I find that just a beautiful place just to like hang out and like, you know, I could see respect to that. But is it white centric? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. I don't know if there's any brothers anytime soon hanging out there. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not just talking about wilderness. Obviously, in places where there's parts of America are very rural and they have access to wilderness, places like Montana. But just European cities are more walkable, and people are closer to more amenities because they developed before the automobile. But the other thing, this is slightly off topic, but I do think as oil prices become more expensive and there's this whole talk of peak oil, American cities will have to contract.
I don't really think that peak oil is a huge issue. I mean, it seems to be that technology is outpacing the geological decline of oil fields. I mean, obviously the price of oil is going up along with the energy you have to expend on getting the oil out of the ground. But it doesn't seem like there'll be an oil crash like the peakists are predicting. Another factor is that we are sort of moving towards cars can be diverse. They can be done on natural gas as well. I mean, in industry, you have cars which are done on natural gas, actually. So there's many potential substitutes. And I know that it's been played up a lot and perhaps overhyped to some extent, but I do think that electric cars are going to be a thing a couple of decades down the line. They're going to be and self-driving cars, which will and the effect of that will actually be that they'll require a lot less fuel in general, because I mean it's going to be much more efficient if you have self-driving cars in terms of fuel expenditure. So I think suburbia should actually be sustainable in that sense.
Well, with self-driving cars, there'll be less need for these massive parking lots. So that will have trends on suburbia into more walkable communities.
Well, yeah, hopefully at least the former car parks could be converted to just parks. I mean, that would be pretty optimal. I don't think that the suburban. I was certainly much more skeptical of the suburban model 7 years ago when I took peak oil more seriously. I mean, in its classic formulation. But nowadays, I think it's just going to be more a story of oil prices steadily just going up, but no shortages as such.
And I think the main reason we are seeing a decline in new suburban sprawl, but I think the main factor, it's not so much peak oil, but it more has to do with the decline in the middle class and the fact that millennials are less likely to start families.
Oh, well, no, I think also the fact that the inner cities are becoming much more attractive of late.
Yeah, that's
as well.
Definitely true as well.
I would say on that part is that the only way you can start a family is if you have money, or if you go outrageously in debt and owe a lot of people money and just go gung-ho with someone else and be like, yeah, we're going to have a kid or two, but we're in debt. So I don't know. It's a very dangerous thing to start a family at a young age today. But if you have the money, if you have a trust fund, then you could do it without, you know, without anxiety. And I think that's really harming, you know, it's a socioeconomic thing, especially if you come from higher up. I mean, as much as I think about starting a family and, you know, how many people on the alt-right have told you, yeah, you got to marry a blonde Valkyrie woman and start your race.
There's Andrew Antlin is decently pushing this white Shabia theme. Have you encountered that?
I mean,
yeah, I have. I mean,
but my experience is like, you know, there are, it's true. The millennials who are like in their mid 20s usually come from like a strange Christian background. Like, you know, they've never really, like, you know, like we talk about T-Bone, Tim T-Bone of like the NFL or something, you know, that Christian guy. He says, I've never had sex. I play football. I'm a quarterback. I never had sex. And I had sex with my first wife. And it's like, it's hard to believe that because you think someone who's like into Rouge V and he's a gamer, he's going to get laid with a lot of women. But it seems to me that these 20s millennials are basically that Tim T-Bone guy where it's just like, yeah, I never had sex my entire life, and now I'm going to have like 4 or 5 children with my millennial wife because we both have trust funds and we live out in the middle of somewhere New Jersey, you know, and it's just like, and they work for some, I don't know, kind of job. But I just find that socioeconomic thing tends to be a burden for a lot of people who deserve to have children, and they should be settling down. I think the neat problem could just go away if we practiced arranged marriage and just got people to be like, all right, this is your girlfriend, this is your wife, and you can't break this alliance, and you're going to have kids, and you're going to have this place to stay. I think a lot of people would be more happier and be more constructive times against men's sexual energy into that. Because if you don't do that, it's going to be like, we're going to have like American jihadists. And people are going to blow up stuff and shoot up schools because they'll go in the afterlife and get promised 500 virgins, you know, or some outrageously. There's a lot of bad things. And I think sexual politics can be easily solved if we can practice marriage at a young age again, instead of giving it to like people in their 30s. Right. And this seems to be a white people thing that's happening, unfortunately.
Well, I think
the stock report endorses white Shadia.
Was that?
The stock report endorses white Shadia.
Well, I think that, you know, the whole idea that you know, people are getting married in their 30s now is something that's that has, in my mind, that has more to do with the fact that people live a lot longer today, and they're able to live a lot younger than they did. It used to be that, you know, I think in like 1900, the life expectancy was like 35, you know,
including children and babies who died much more frequently. If you exclude them, then the life expectancy was actually around 65 or 70, so like just a decade or 15 years less than today. So not that
much. Yeah, so it's the difference between the average and the mean. Medium.
Yeah, but even still, I mean, you had, you know, people would pump out that many babies because they, number one, they didn't care, but they were also, you know, if they lived on a farm or something, those weren't just like mouths to feed, but also like potential, you know, workers to be part of like a family enclave or something. I don't think that, you know, arranged marriages is going to come back. I think that's something that's just like a fantasy of like, you know, like video game nerds or something that like just don't like are just too lazy to go out and like, you know, develop the skills to actually go talk to a female in public. Like, you know, like maybe it's just my generation because, you know, I'm 38, but, you know, we used to go out and like, you go places and you would meet girls and just talk to them. Like it wasn't like a big deal. Like I feel like some of these like Generation Z kids, like they're just like out of their fucking minds. Like they're just like, they're just crazy. They're just crazy. Like they have like,
you're
even
right.
When I watch their YouTube videos and stuff and like, all of like even just the weird like tranny makeup tutorials and stuff. Ew. It's all just like they're all just so fucking freaky that like, you know. And I'm not even like any kind of, you know, real traditional conservative. I just mean that like they're, you know, their brains are just like are just bizarre, and they have like, their social skills are built around like these video game networking chats and stuff like that, and it's so alien to me.
I think it's like I kind of put it as a divide between the introverts and the extroverts, and I think a lot of this intellectualism is in metapolitics is coming from the class of introverts, and because of technology like Skype and Discord and the internet has created a new introverted culture, or at least that memes are made by the introverts. Meanwhile, we have these the cool kids club, or the KKK, I like to call them the extroverts, that believe they're so cool because they go out and they're social. I mean, this sounds like an anti-normie speech, because it is an anti-normie speech. But these extroverts basically, you know, they basically tell others, and they be snobs about it, like, well, I go out and I have a life. So you better just stay home with your mom, because I'm having the time of my life. You should be jealous. And these extroverts, pretty much what they do is they get drunk, do drugs, promiscuous sex. That's what they claim. But I don't think it really happens. I just think they're a bunch of loners doing things in the consumer society. And so you see these two classes of extroverts and introverts. And I think there seems to be a civil war between the two parties, and you can never have both the mix between the introvert doing his duty at home and his art and his time to go out and be extroverted or at least do these things. But I could see that with these generations is everything is becoming like an autonomized individual bubble. You really don't see this. It's okay or safe to go places. Like if I go to a place where people gather and congregate, what am I just going to do? Go up to a girl and say, hey, you want to go out? I mean, according to Rush V, you could supposedly do that, but we have this new culture.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, but I'm saying is
like
we have
you
this
could
new
just
culture.
Go, you go up to them and say, hey, how's it going? Like, you know, when I was a kid, like I've talked about this before, like, you know, you used to have to like work to make friends. Like, you couldn't just go online and just start like chatting with people, you know, like you had to like, in fact, like your parents would like make you like, you know, I don't, you know, why don't you go over to, you know, down to the strip mall up there and try to meet, go to the arcade up there. You know, maybe you'll meet somebody. You'll be like, well, I don't want to go.
It's so funny because
I want to stay here.
Well, the thing is today there is this whole culture where it's socially unacceptable to make
exactly
to talk to strangers in public. If you approach someone, they think you're either a weirdo
or a creeper
or some kind
and that's
yeah,
terrible. It's funny because I live right next to
I don't think that's true at all. Like, I mean, you can go out and meet people all the time. It's just like you just don't be that creepy about it, you know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
not
yeah.
that hard. Like, you know, if you go get a job at like a you know, at fucking like Pizza Hut or something, like you're going to meet girls if you work there. Like, it's not, it's obviously if you just go up to some stranger, like in just the slimiest, like creepiest way possible, like without any kind of, you know, any kind of tact or anything. And it's like, and you know, I hate to sound like a PUA because like, I hate those guys, but it's like, you know, you have to go out and meet people. It's not that hard. Like, I don't, you know, I just don't like being, you know, being told that like we need to bring back like arranged marriages and this kind of thing, because some people are like just too like chicken shit to go up and like talk to chicks, you know,
yeah,
in public. Like they got to ruin it for everybody. At least like then these they're just like entitled, you know, some that just have some girl, you know, because. And these arranged marriages were they never actually, you know, work that well. It's just another one of those things that's like these like traditionalist fantasies. Or, well, you know, we bring back arrangement. Well, those arranged marriages, like those people hated each other. Some of them were like abusive. Like you see that in these weird like Mormon cults, you know, where the women have to fucking escape because.
Back to the topic of the basic income and automation. I do think a lot of these issues that Rabbit and Pilliter were discussing, like social isolation, I think they could be exacerbated in the future with automation and a lot of advances in technology. Anatoly Karlin, what are your thoughts on that and those trends in the future? And how automation will affect basically family formation and how people socialize with each other?
Mm-hmm. Extrapolating from current trends, more and more of the socialization will move online, I assume. We have Tinder already today for short-term hookups, and we'll probably have more of that. As I said, if there is going to be a basic income, then I think that family formation might actually become easier in the sense that, but this is not exclusively my idea actually, because the blogger Randall Parker, who blogs at Future Pundit, he has also argued that that automation will actually be pro fertility on average.
By pro fertility, do you mean for the underclass or for everyone? Like, do you think it will have more of a dysgenic effect, or will it benefit everyone?
I think that as things are, it will probably be indeed more dysgenic than eugenic. I don't think the underlying trend in that respect will change.
Anatoly, you did partake in a debate on immigration and the basic income for a transhumanist convention in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Was the debate explicitly pro versus anti-immigration, or pro versus anti-basic income, or both?
Oh, well, this was like back in 2015, I think, so I can't really recollect that debate very well, even though it's on my YouTube channel. Transhumanists, in my experience, they actually approach things from a wide perspective, so they're pretty open to considering issues from different perspectives, so they're actually pretty open to, even though they are liberals for the most part. I mean, they really hate the term, for instance, on average. They are still willing to consider anti-immigration arguments based on HPD factors, say, and on the effects of immigration on other policies such as basic income. I think the anti-immigration side actually won 55% to 45%, actually, if I recall correctly.
So you were the main person debating on that stance, or several other people?
Well, yeah, I mean, if I recall correctly, it was me and Mike Johnson, who's a qualia researcher. I'm going to plug his work a bit. He's studying how to...
I met him when we were in Berkeley.
Yes, he did. Yeah. So he's studying how to quantify qualia, the experience of consciousness. We're basically at the voodoo stage of science as regards consciousness, and he wants to formalize it and construct mathematical models to explain it. So it's pretty fascinating. But yeah, I mean, he's open to these arguments, and he was my partner on the anti-immigration side of the debate.
And who was representing the pro-immigration side?
It was Scott Jackish, who's the head of the East Bay Futurist, and some other guy. Scott Jackish isn't like really pro-immigration per se, but I think he mostly took it on as an intellectual challenge, he has a strong opinion about.
We interviewed him on here before. I think that's Oakland Futurist.
Oh, yes,
right?
We did.
Yeah. We interviewed him. Cool dude. I like him.
Yeah. Here, by the way, he recently wrote a book called The Robot Overlord Scenario. You should probably do another interview with him.
He did bring it up when we were interviewing him, but he did. Mm-hmm. What happened is he had some snippets of it published on his website, so it was just released.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it still needs some work, so it needs to be tidied up. But the main body of work is complete. It's exactly 50,000 words. So I mean, he did it as part of the Nano Demo Challenge, which is National Novel Writing Month, which happens every November. I also participated, but only though 2,000 words. So I failed.
I participated and did. It took me longer to write Almond Eyes Baby Face, so I just published it or something. And I'm not so sure if the school board would be okay with reading erotic fiction. So.
As far as immigration policy goes, the alt-right advocates a complete shutdown on immigration or like a whites-only policy. But in some ways, like, do you see that as realistic as white Sharia?
So, I mean, minimal immigration obviously is feasible. So, I mean, I think Japan pretty much proves the case. I mean, they've got how many, like a couple of dozen people successfully applying for asylum each year, something like that. They have a few hundred thousand ethnic Koreans, but that's from the imperial days. So I think, yes, it's possible. And I obviously I don't support importing low uneducated workers. Or low IQ population groups, but I'm also pretty skeptical about imposing high IQ people as well, because I mean, they'll probably benefit the economy to be sure, but
well, the GDP might... of the economy, not the life standards of your average worker.
Well, it might improve it somewhat as well through the hive mind effect. I mean. Because a lot of what the high IQ produce it trickles down anyway. But I mean the problems you do have real problems though that if there's like regression to the mean, for instance, if you're importing high IQ applicants, you're also depriving them because they don't have many smart fractions in the first place. So you're depriving them of that as well. That's if you're talking about low IQ population groups. If you are talking about high IQ population groups like the Chinese, well, you might import them, but then they might have cultural incompatibilities, or they might end up being more loyal to their. Because I mean, whites are pretty non-ethnocentric by global standards. So I mean, this is something that's discussed a lot in the HBD sphere. And other population groups might tend to band together or advance their own more frequently than the white societies. So, I mean, I don't really see it as being necessary, to be fair. I mean, I would just much rather focus on like, upgrading ourselves to, like, CRISPR than improving IQ via gene editing and artificial wombs, like breeding a race of Superman through artificial wombs and CRISPR clinics. That's my vision.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, I've written about this a lot before, like these, you know, a lot of the libertarians where they always say like, oh, well, I'm just against like, you know, low skilled, low IQ immigration, but like, I want to bring in the high IQ people. But when you're importing these high IQ people from other countries, in a way it's almost worse because you're bringing in these highly intelligent people and putting them in powerful positions and whatnot. Like, you know, Microsoft has an Indian CEO. So when you bring these people in and you that have, you know, no real loyalty to this country, then, you know, are you really importing them into this country or you're just importing them into these positions of, you know, transnational corporations where they immediately have no loyalty to the U.S. So suddenly you've imported this guy that's a high IQ, you know, immigrant from China or something. And what's the first thing, do you think that he's going to care about, you know, American workers or even the local community where he's at? You know, probably not. Is he going to be more or less likely to support moving, operations to China or, you know, having more favorable
trade policies of these other countries, or, you know, someone from India is going to be probably more likely to support outsourcing and bringing in more low skilled workers from India and these other places. So I think that in a way it's even worse because, yeah, you're bringing in people that are smart, but if they have no loyalty to this country, you're not really bringing them into anything. In fact, you're just putting them into positions of power where they can potentially undermine you.
So as far as immigration goes, what Rabbit was saying, a lot of conservatives and Donald Trump are proposing a Canadian-style merit-based immigration system that Canada has. But their situation is that Canada, most of their immigration comes from basically China and India. Mm-hmm. I think if you're not, unless you, if we're not going to say shut down immigration completely, we are going to allow some degree of legal immigration. I think the best case scenario would be to maybe limit the numbers and then have a merit-based immigration system, but have some kind of a requirement that there is a geographic diversity, so we don't end up with a situation where we have one or two countries taking up the entire slots like Canada does.
That seems logical.
We are at the end of the show. Anatoly Karlin, well, do you like to be back on in, say, about a month to talk about transhumanism?
Sure, yeah, that would be fun. Maybe Dudashek could join us as well, because he expressed an interest in that and as well.
Well, thanks again for being on, Anatoly, and also thanks for having us later.
It's nice talking to you guys, like always.
Thanks, guys.